39. You have searched me, Lord, and you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You are familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you, Lord, know it completely. You hem me in behind and before, and you lay your hands upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me. Your right hand will hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me, and the light become night around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for darkness is as light to you. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. How precious to me are your thoughts, God. How vast is the sum of them. Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand. When I awake, I am still with you.
So you have a handout which will show you where we're going. This is the first of a three-part series on the human race, what it is to be a human being. And the reason essentially I'm doing this is partly, there aren't many series I haven't done here, but I hadn't actually done this taught on the nature of humanity. But also because it is a key issue as we think about our culture. As you think about some of the big issues in our culture, issues to do with racism, gender and transgender movements, sexuality, abortion, disability, euthanasia, end of life, all of those things revolve around this question, what does it mean to be a human being? Somebody has essentially argued that if the big issue around the sort of period of the Reformation was what does it mean to be saved, the big issue in our culture and indeed in our churches at the beginning of the 21st century is what does it mean to be a human being? They do go that tightly together. And many of the issues around what does it mean to a human being have an impact on some of the decisions that churches make in those sort of areas. And so part of my hope is that this series will equip us as we seek to live in our culture. But as well as being a big cultural issue, it's also an issue to do with how we feel about ourselves. I'm not going to ask this question as in I'm not going to look for a response. But I wonder if I throw out the question, I wonder, do you actually like yourself? What that would do to us? Some of the emotions that would sort of kick in, actually. I suspect for many of us, we kind of think, yeah, I just wish I had a slightly different personality. I wish I was slightly less shy. I wish I was slightly more outgoing. Or, you know, I wish I looked slightly different. I mean, I grew up with ginger hair. You know, I wish I looked slightly different. And all these sort of random sort of prejudice that you can throw out and offend people. All of those issues go to do with what it is to be a human being. I actually forgot Jonathan was there. I was thinking, I could get away with this. I'm the only one. More seriously, those can raise issues of quite deep self-esteem, actually. How do we come to a place of security? And so this question of what it is to be a human being, I think is vital culturally. I'm also convinced that it's vital pastorally as well. As I reflected on the culture and the culture in which we live, particularly actually with one of my hats on now, working with Living Out and speaking a lot into subjects of sexuality, what I've realised is that, so you look at those big cultural issues, you've got to go backwards. So when I speak into questions of sexuality, the standard talk that I give starts like this. Before we talk about sexuality, you've got to go backwards and think about identity. What is the essence of who we are? And as you look at our culture, essentially, there are two main ways of determining identity, two main ways of working out the most important thing about us. The main view in our culture that isn't actually argued for, it's just assumed, is this. I am my deepest, inmost desires. How do I work out how to live or who I am? I look inside myself, see what's there, and live it out. I am fundamentally my deepest desires. Let me give you an example that I might have used this here before at some point. But Nigel Owens was the most successful rugby referee in the world. He's now retired, but refereed the 2015 Rugby World Cup final. He's also gay and talked in one or two interviews around the time he refereed the Rugby World Cup final about some of the emotions growing up in a Welsh village. Tragically, actually, there was an attempt on his own life. Before he comes to a place of acceptance, here's what he said. I couldn't accept who I was, and I didn't want to be the person I was becoming. I didn't want to be gay. But after I accepted who I was, the next challenge was whether rugby would accept who I am. Rugby has supported me, and players, spectators, pundits, and administrators have all enabled me to be who I am. Now, I reckon you've got to be fairly hard-hearted not to feel the force of a story like that, actually. So growing up with a deep sense of unease, comes to a place of acceptance, goes off and has a successful career. It sounds like a redemption story in many ways. But do you want to notice the assumption that lies behind it? The assumption is that sexuality equals identity. Is it three times in the quote he says, who I am, who I am, who I am? In other words, what am I? Who am I? I am my sexuality. That's who I am. Those are my deepest desires. And therefore, if that is who I am, I'm called to live that out. Carl Truman, who's a British writer based in the States, massive tome, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, analyzes culture from a Christian perspective and talks about the cultural phenomenon being that of expressive individualism. Who am I? I am my deepest desires, and those must be expressed. Or talks about the psychologizing of human identity. I am what I think, what I feel, how I would be psychologically analyzed. And that's the culture in which we live. And it seems to me as we think about all the cultural questions around gender, around sexuality, we've got to understand that's what's going on. We'll only understand our culture if we realize the prevailing view that isn't argued for, it's just assumed, I am my deepest desires. Now, I want to say this. If there's no God, that's probably the best we can do. So actually, if there isn't a God, look inside yourself, see what's there, and live it out might be the best thing we can manage. But what if there is a God? And what if that God knows me better than I know myself? And what if that God knows what's best for me better than I know myself? Because he's my creator. If that's the case, the best way to do life won't be look inside yourself, see what's there and live it out. It will be listen to the voice outside you, telling you who you are, bestowing a better identity on you that you get to live out. In other words, the basic question that underlines most things is this: what's the universe about? Does the universe work best with me and my desires center stage, or does the universe work best with God and his plan center stage? Certainly as I end up engaging with people on the subject of sexuality, non-Christian friends and so on, who are slightly mystified by some of the decisions I've made, I end up saying this. It kind of depends what you think the universe is about. You actually really do need to go all the way back there, it seems to me. What's the universe about? Me and my desire center stage, or God and his plan center stage. Now, for the remainder of the series, I'm going to assume there's a God. I thought I knew you well enough to work out that was probably a safe assumption here. And essentially what I'm going to do for the rest of this series is give a biblical approach to humanity that is an answer to this sort of cultural prevailing view. So if the cultural view is, I am my deepest desires, what is a Christian response to that? That's essentially what the next 2 and a bit weeks is all about. And the first thing to say is that in God's eyes, human beings are those who are made in the image of God. So familiar stuff right from the opening chapter of the Bible, where we read these words in Genesis 1, verse 26. Then God said, "Let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. And actually, verse 28, God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground." Now, I want to argue that the best thing for us as human beings, the thing actually that will contribute most to a sense of dignity, that will contribute actually to good mental health and so on, is grasping those realities, because this is what we are made for. We are at our most human when we believe these things. And the key thing we're to grasp about ourselves is that we are made in the image of God. Now, it's a lovely phrase that gives us great dignity. It's true of us, it's not true of the animals. The difficulty with the phrase "made in the image of God" is this: nobody's quite sure what it means. Because actually, as you look through the Bible, there isn't a clear, this is what the image of God means. That there just isn't a clear passage that elaborates that. And so often what people will do will say something like this: well, you know, God is the creator, and so as human beings, we're going to be creative and make stuff. At least some people are creative. You know, God is relational. He's Trinity. And, you know, so we should be relational and relate to each other. And I kind of understand that. But, of course, that does slightly, you know, God is everywhere. And so, oh, whoops, that doesn't quite work. More than that, it becomes problematic, because what happens if somebody has a mental disability such that actually they struggle to be creative and relate to people? Does that mean they're no longer made in the image of God? I think there is a problem actually with pinning it down to God has these abilities, we have these abilities, therefore we're made in the image of God. I think it's slightly different to that. Although there's an element of truth in that, I don't think that can be exhaustive. I think the closest we get to a meaning is this. If you flick forward to Genesis 5, sorry, you might need to follow your Bible a bit, actually, because, sorry, I've moved house this week, which meant the PowerPoint isn't quite as detailed as it might have been. So Genesis 5, verses 1, 2, 3. This is the written account of Adam's family line. When God created mankind, he made them in the likeness of God. He created them male and female, and he blessed them, and he named them mankind when they were created. When Adam lived 130 years, he had a son in his own likeness, in his own image, and he named him Seth. Now, that's quite interesting, because it uses exactly the same language. So God makes Adam in his own image, and then Adam has a son in his own image, same language. And so if you're wanting a biblical idea as to what it means to be made in the image of, it's like a parent and a child. That's actually the way the Bible uses that language. In other words, the main thing that a child will say is, I have come from somewhere. You know, I've come from my parents, and you know, you pick up certain wonderful similarities to your parents. I don't know, like ginger hair, you know, which is obviously a wonderful thing to have from parents. And so you pick up a certain likeness from your parents. And that's the image that is used with us and God. Now, What that means is this, two things. That gives us, firstly, great dignity, because it means we've got the best parent of all. We have come from God, who is our loving, wise, kind Heavenly Father. We are made after His likeness, after His image. And we have come from somewhere. What is vital and healthy for human beings to grasp is this. We didn't create ourselves. We were made in the image of another, in the likeness of another. We owe our existence to another. We are creatures and we are dependent upon Him. We cannot think of what it is to be human without thinking about God. Now, if you think about it, that is astonishingly striking. Because in all the discussions around various ethical issues at the moment, God is invisible. And I want to say you can't even start to have a conversation about what it is to be human without God figuring in the equation. Because the first and foremost thing is we are from Him, made in His likeness, just as we come from parents, so ultimately we come from our ultimate parent, who is God. And we're given responsibility. We're given work to do. So, do you notice, actually, that Adam is given the responsibility to rule over various things, to take care of creation? And again, inherent within human dignity is that sense of work. It's why unemployment can be really difficult for people, because in a sense, it's one way in which we're not part of Eden. Actually, work is part of what it is to be a human being. But what I want to underline before I give you the chance to talk to each other is how revolutionary Genesis 1:27 is, that we are those who are made in the image of God. Because this becomes the basis throughout the Bible for how human beings are to be treated. So, actually, you may well do this next week in James chapter 3. In James chapter 3, you will look at the way in which we're to use our tongue. And the point that James makes is this: we shouldn't curse those who are made in the image of God. You know, why should you speak well to other human beings? Because they are made in God's image. Actually, every time we relate to another person, whether we're speaking to them or speaking about them, the thing we have in our mind is they are made in the image of God and so they are valuable. In other words, it becomes the basis for how we treat each other. And it becomes the basis for our fundamental equality, the fundamental equality that we have as human beings. Sorry, I thought just to keep you awake on a hot afternoon, I would show you my holiday photos because, hey, what more thrilling thing can there be for people to look at? I've only been to the States once, actually. And on my one visit to the States, I visited New York and saw the Statue of Liberty. And at the Statue of Liberty, there was this sort of exhibition. And it was fascinating and it was really well put together. If you'll forgive me, I suppose the one thing about the exhibition was that it was mildly self-congratulatory, sort of basically how we found liberty and how we found equality and how it was all our idea, a little bit. And I remember as I was walking around this exhibition in New York, and actually the genuine thing that struck me as we discovered that liberty and equality were founded in the 18th century, part of me was just left thinking, it's as old as Genesis 1. I'm sorry, we did get there first. Because if you think about it, Genesis 1:27 is an earth-shattering statement, particularly as you think about how old it is. That right back in Genesis 1 is the foundation for human equality. Because all human beings are made in the image of God and therefore are worthy of equal dignity, worth, and respect. That's astonishing as you think about it. You know, a value that we do esteem as a society is as old as Genesis 1. Human beings are made in the image of God and this becomes their basis for their fundamental equality. Glenn Scrivener, the evangelist, has written a book recently entitled The Air We Breathe. It's a really useful book, actually, because he argues that all that is good in society owes its basis to Christian foundations. And he basically explores all the things we tend to value have a Christian basis. He writes this, the God story and the equality story stand or fall together. Because his point, and this illustration might work for people of my generation, he says the problem with our culture at the moment is it's a bit like wacky races. Now, wacky races, it's that, I've got missed, okay, they know, yeah, okay. Oh, Isaac, Isaac, is you are living up to your reputation being 20 years older than you are, but I'm in D-Bob happy, aren't I? Just offending everybody. Principle of wacky races is you just have lots of sort of cars sort of driving along in these sort of cartoon characters. And what happens is at various points, the car heads over the cliff. And as the car heads over a cliff, there's then a pause before it suddenly sinks to the sort of floor. And Glenn Scrivener's his illustration basically says that's where our culture is. In a sense, we want to value things like equality. We want to value equality of race. We want to value equality in irrespective of people's social backgrounds. It's just actually as a culture, we haven't really got a basis for it. There's actually nothing underpinning that, no substance to it, because God is increasingly written out of the picture. Christians have got a basis for it because we believe human beings are all made in the image of God. But actually, there isn't a strong secular basis for valuing the disabled person as much as the able-bodied person. Not if you just talk about economic usefulness, you aren't. In a sense, they're hovering over a cliff with nothing underneath it. And there's a pause going on at the moment because people haven't clocked it. But it does make you worry for the future. Whereas actually, if we want to value things like equality, then the Christian has the basis for it. We're all made in the image of God. And this has become the basis for huge changes down through the culture. So, back in the period when late 18th, early 19th century, through Wilberforce and others, there were the campaigns against the slave trade. Here is a coin, a medallion that was disputed at the time. You know, a man in chains, probably having been brutally and appallingly kidnapped from Africa, there in chains being led off to slavery. And the message on these anti-slavery medallions was this, am I not a man and a brother? In other words, am I not, as a human being, also a fellow brother with you because we're all made in the image of God? And if that is the case, how can you treat me like this? Right from all being made in the image of God, fundamentally undermines the hideous evil of the slave trade. Abraham Lincoln, when he was campaigning against slavery, put it like this, nothing stamped with the divine image and likeness was sent into the world to be trodden on and degraded and imbruted by its fellows. Now, can I say that is vital as we think about where Christians should stand on various ethical issues? Can I say, I actually find engaging with ethical issues really complex these days because there are various people I find to be friends on some issues and not on others. Let me explain what I mean by that. As we'll go on, I do have views about how we're made, male and female, and that being linked to how we're made biologically. Having said that, I also want to be on the same side as those who take issues like racism extremely seriously. And the following problem is, I actually end up on different sides of a lot of debates, actually. Because often those who are sort of arguing for quite a conservative position, or those who are saying, oh, this Black Lives Matter, let's just ignore that. Whereas I actually think we need to be arguing quite strongly for how we're created, and we need to be very serious about the evil of racism. And actually, sometimes it's quite hard to work out how do you put those two things together. Can I just, every time I hear Christians dismiss, oh, it's just woke stuff, I'm always slightly uneasy with that, actually. Because I guess woke at one level means being aware of and alert to social injustice. And actually, if we believe in human equality, then issues of racism, issues of unfairness of opportunity in economic terms should be things that matter to us because we believe in the fundamental equality of all human beings. In a sense, that should matter. Social justice should be a Christian concern. And so Palmy just wants to use this to encourage us to think a little bit. How do we actually argue for the fundamental equality of all human beings? Two things before I get you to talk to each other. John Wyatt is a Christian ethicist, and he has done a bit of reflecting in thinking, what are the main ways in which we show inequality to people? Who are the types of people who often we ignore? And so he argues, the fetus, the newborn infants, the disabled child, the brain-damaged adults, the elderly suffering with Alzheimer's, and the psychiatric patients. All people made in the image of God, of equal worth and dignity to your successful middle-class person having a great career. Fundamental equality and dignity. And I think in a sense our society kind of wants that. But here's the actual basis for it. Human beings are made in the image of God. And then how should we view ourselves? You know, again, for some of us, issues of self-esteem will be deep. Actually, there'll be quite a deep longing that we wish somehow we were different. Somehow we had a different personality. Somehow we wish we'd been given different bodies and so on. Graham Byrne in his book Mirror Mirror, it's about 13 years old now, but has a really helpful phrase for how we should view ourselves. We should have a humble dignity. Dignity because we are made in the image of God. Dignity because God has bestowed that value upon us. Dignity because, if you like, we are the children of the heavenly parents, given responsibility to do his work in the world, and yet humble. Because none of that have we earned for ourselves. None of that have we acquired for ourselves. None of that have we achieved for ourselves. That is something that is given to us. Now, let me give you 5 or 6 minutes just to talk to people near you. Basically, what struck you? If nothing has struck you, feel free to talk about your plans for the week. But if anything has struck you, then feel free to share whatever you were alert enough to take in. Go for it. But hey. What I want to do is to flesh out now two more ways in which the way we're created has an impact, again, on culture and on our own sense of self. So in the remaining time, I want to look at being made body and soul and then being made male and female. So as you look at the creation accounts in Genesis chapter 2, verse 7, you get this. Then the Lord God formed a man from the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living being. And there's something interesting going on there. You have the sense of a physical body that is made and something to do with the life of God being breathed within, which isn't explicit but is interesting. And then in Psalm 139, which Voon kindly read for us, you have a wonderful celebration from David of the way in which he's made. You created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. And so we are those whose body has been made by God. The body we have is not an accident. Yes, in many ways, some of the aches and the pains and the more serious disabilities we face are a result of the fall, but our fundamental bodies are not accidents, but were designed by God. But then you have, again, Jesus himself, doesn't he, speaks of the soul. What does it profit a person to gain the whole world and yet to forfeit their soul? Or Paul, actually, I hadn't deliberately planned this, actually, but I read the end of 1 Thessalonians 5 at the end of the morning service. May your whole spirit, soul, and body be kept blameless at the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ. Now, truth be told, I think it's quite hard to work out the difference between the soul and the spirit, actually. If anybody's got any wisdom on that, I'd love to hear it. But what you do clearly have a sense of as you look at the different descriptions of humanity is we are deliberately given physical bodies, and there is a soul within, a soul that relates to God, a soul that is put there by God, a soul that will last forever. And a true vision of humanity will recognize both. Now, where culture will often give us a problem is by basically knocking one of those two out. Historically, probably as we look back sort of, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, an atheistic worldview would knock the soul out. And so what are human beings? Human beings are just stuff. We're just matter. So Stephen Hawking, the scientist who died a number of years ago, basically said this: I regard the brain as a computer which will stop working. Who am I? Basically, I'm just a computer. And one day, the computer will get old, it will die, and that's it. End of story. Now, I don't know whether you've ever thought of yourself as basically a computer, but in a sense, that is the atheistic worldview. We're just matter. We're just stuff. Stuff that one day will die, go into the ground and rot, and that's all we are. Now, I want to say instinctively, we tend to rebel against that. We kind of instinctively, I think there is a me. There is a me that is more than just physical stuff. I guess we kind of want to think love is more than just a random chemical reaction in the brain. In a sense, a kind of something that reduces us down to just physical matter, instinctively we rebel against. But historically, that has been a view. We are just physical matter. Increasingly, though, I think in our contemporary culture, it's actually the body that we regard as unimportant. Remember how I started, actually, our fundamental identity: look inside yourself, see what's there, and live it out. And yet the Bible's worldview is this: the physical bodies that we have are part of God's design, are part of God's gift to us. We are made embodied souls. Body and soul matters. Back in the second century, actually, Justin Martyr put it like this: it is evident that man made in the image of God was of flesh. Adam was physical. Is it not then absurd to say that the flesh made by God in his own image is contemptible and worth nothing? Our bodies and our souls matter. Now, probably the way that manifests itself most in contemporary debates is around the transgender movement, actually. How do I work out if I'm male or female? Now, I'm aware, by the way, that there are a relatively small number, but nevertheless a number, where that is confusing because of an intersex condition. And I just want to acknowledge that is a reality. One of the reasons, the fall affects lots of things, including physical disability in a heap of ways. And it seems to me the intersex condition is just one of the agonizing realities of life in a broken world. Nevertheless, it is the case that the majority, and actually even those with an intersex condition, even the majority of those, there is a clear male, female given by our bodies. And it seems to me a Christian worldview will say that our sex is not simply something we discern, but is something that is given to us by God, and our gender actually is given to us by God in our physical bodies. That is part of what it is to be embodied. Rather than saying, I've got to discover the real me within myself, we are made body and soul. Now, let me apply that a little bit pastorally, because, again, you will be aware that I'm massive into sort of culture war type territory with issues of trans and so on. It does seem to me that saying that all human beings are made in the image of God and are made body and soul should give us clarity as to where we should land on that. Our bodies matter, and our bodies do determine, it seems to me, the gender that we're to live out. But it will also determine the tone in which we use as we engage in such discussions. In other words, we will speak of everybody with dignity and respect because everybody is made in the image of God. And that will give us clarity, but it will also affect the tone in which we speak. Again, partly in my work with living out, although truth be told, gender's never been a particular issue for me, It has been for a couple of my colleagues, actually. And where they've ended up landing is recognizing that their physical bodies matter. So let me tell you about a male colleague of mine who basically grew up, and as he was growing up, realizing all the things he liked doing were traditionally female-type things. And that left him pretty confused, actually. Who do I actually belong to? And the clarity he's come to, and I think this is right biblically, is given he has a male physical body, he is a man. But actually, given that the Bible doesn't say a huge amount about what men should and shouldn't do in terms of what they should like, he will say, it is fine to be a man who relaxes before going to bed by watching an episode of Downton Abbey, and that is fine. Because actually, there's nothing in the Bible that says men have to like sports. That's fine. I think he's come to the right position, actually. I'm given a physical body that is male. If I predominantly like things that culturally are regarded as feminine, that's okay. Or a female colleague of mine who would have it the opposite way around. She says one of the most painful experiences she had as a young Christian was going to a church weekend away. And on the church weekend away, there was an afternoon of compulsory fun. And in the afternoon of compulsory fun, it was kind of split. The guys were going off to do some go-karting, and the women were going to stay behind and make candles. And she was saying, do I really want to be part of this thing? Because, frankly, there is nothing in the Bible that says I should prefer making candles to wanting to go go-karting. And she's right, actually, there isn't. But she's come to the position of saying, well, actually, I've got a female body. I am a woman who actually most of the things she likes doing most is playing pool and going go-karting. And it seems to me that is fine, actually, because there's no biblical command to say women must do certain things. Now, there are differences. We'll come on to them in a minute. But the point I want to make is this. We are embodied people. And so we want to point people to physical realities. And that is part of saying my identity is going to come from God. It is God who has given me my physical body. And I'm going to accept that and live with that. Sam Albury puts it like this, basically summarizing what we've just said. Is the body you? Yes. You know, the true self is not what's hidden in the body. No, our body is part of who we are. It is intrinsic to who you are. But it's not the totality of who you are, because we're made body and soul. And again, I think that's just helpful, both as we engage culturally and also as we think about ourselves. And then lastly, we're made male and female. You see that again in Genesis 1, verse 27, is that there is this distinction between male and female that is made. God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. And basically, as you look at the Bible's picture, the Bible argues that men and women are equal and distinct. Equal and distinct. So notice, made in the image of God, there is a fundamental equality between men and women. Now, again, can I push on some things slightly? Just as I said, I get slightly nervous when Christians denounce kind of wokeism because I think we should be concerned about racial justice. In the same way, can I be honest, I'm also slightly nervous when I just hear Christians denounce feminism, actually. Because there are certain things that, of course, are right. Should men and women be paid the same amount for the same job? Absolutely they should. Should men and women be given the... Of course they should. Again, that's Genesis 1:27. Didn't need the... Well, you did need the suffragettes. Tragically, you needed the suffragettes. But in a sense, if culture had been thinking sensibly, men and women would always be given the vote. And actually, that fundamental equality is vital. In fact, that is the main truth here, actually. The main truth is the fundamental equality between men and women, and something we should be passionate about. Nevertheless, there is also a distinction that is picked up. So the fact that Adam is made first and then Eve second does actually become a truth that the rest of the Bible picks up. Eve is created to be Adam's helper. Now, again, can I say the word helper doesn't imply inequality? inasmuch as actually the main being described as a helper in the Bible is God. And obviously that doesn't imply any kind of inequality there, quite the reverse. And so helper doesn't imply inequality. But nevertheless, this does become a basis for different roles within the church and within family. I did quite a bit of this time last year as we looked at 1 Timothy, I think, where we did talk about the fact that within the church, the fact that man was made first does become the basis for instance, a male eldership. And there is a difference of roles given in Ephesians 5 and 1 Peter 3 between men and women in terms of marriage. So husbands are faithfully to love their wife as Christ does the church, and there is a call for wives to submit to the husband as the church submits to Christ. But you might ask, why has God made it that way? Why has God made male, female, equal and distinct? Three reasons. Partly because it's good. I mean, can you imagine a world where there was just men? I mean, can you imagine it? I mean, that would be an absolute nightmare, wouldn't it? Or, well, I mean, probably less bad, but imagine a world where there was just women. And actually, can I push us towards enjoying the complementarity of that position? You know, my ministry and whatever I've done over the last number of years has been vastly enriched by learning from women. And sorry, I hope that doesn't sound patronizing, but I just need to say that actually. You know, there's my colleagues at UCF, colleagues here, those of you in the church, there are perspectives that I've learned on life and ministry from women that I didn't learn from men. And that's as it should be. And actually, if you're a guy thinking, you know, you've got a strong view of the distinctive roles, which means, well, you know, I'm not supposed to learn from women, that's nonsense. As part of a church family, of course, we're to be learning from each other and teaching one another. God has deliberately made that complementarity. It also reflects God. Do you notice male and female, in some sense, is important because we are made in the image of God? And you get this argued in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, actually. So in 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 3, you get this. But I want you to realize that the head of every man is Christ, and the head of the woman is man, and the head of Christ is God. And you do get something going on there that picks up the Father and the Son and their relationship, because they are equal and distinct in role, which actually is what you see in male-female, equal and distinct in role. Now, believe me, you really need to understand that the Father and the Son are equal. Actually, if you doubt that, you've got bigger issues than just to do with men and women. You've just become a heretic, basically. Father and the Son are equal and yet distinct. And the male-female relationship, in some sense, is a reflection and an image of that. And the last reason it's necessary that there are men and women is basically so that there can be a picture of eternity. Because the whole of the human history is heading towards a great and glorious wedding day between Jesus and the church. Actually, the wedding that is going to last, the marriage that is going to last forever and ever and ever. And what is the picture of that? The picture we get in this world, the portrait, if you like, of eternity is the marriage of a man and a woman. And actually, if God had only created men or only created women, it wouldn't be able to picture that, actually. Because in eternity, Jesus doesn't marry Jesus, and in eternity, the church doesn't marry the church. I mean, the church marrying the church without Jesus would leave you with an eternity of notices. It basically has to be a picture of people who are different, a man and a woman, a picture of Christ and the church forever. That is why God made it that way, so that within the very fabric of society would be a picture of what the new creation is going to be like. And so don't you see God's wisdom in making us male and female? It's good for us now. It's good for us because actually the distinction and the equality gives us a picture of what God himself is like, and because it's a picture of eternity and the ultimate marriage. Basically, what I want to argue is that God has given humanity a great dignity and worth, because we're made in his own image. And if you want one last hint as to how much dignity he gives the human race, he does so by becoming human himself. And actually, all that we've looked at, God himself takes on as he comes down and becomes human, so that ultimately, and we'll see this by the time we get to July, he can raise up humanity back to where it was and even higher. Because seated at the right-hand side of God the Father now is a man with a body. Because Jesus still has his body. And if you doubt that the human race matters to God, the Father looks and there is a man sitting beside him. It's a wonderful thing to be a human being. As we'll see next week, there are issues, but it's a wonderful thing to be a human being made by God. Let me pray. Father, we've covered an awful lot of ground over the last hour or so. So Father, please help us to just to hold on to what matters most. Lord, may we think about ourselves truly and rightly. But Lord, we also want to pray that you would enable us to live as confident Christians in our culture and actually to believe that this image that you have given us of human beings, male, female, body and soul, made in your image, is wonderfully liberating for human flourishing. And so, Lord, in a world where there are so many competing worldviews, help us to be convinced that what we have really is the best. And it's the best because it's the identity that you have bestowed upon us. And we thank you and praise you. Amen. Let's sing our closing song.